from API. This is Energy Tomorrow Radio, your source for information and conversation about the most important energy issues of the day.
Hello, I'm Jane Van Ryan, your host for this edition of Energy Tomorrow Radio. Today we're talking with Guy Caruso of the Energy Information Administration, which is a division of the U.S. Department of Energy, and Rayola Dewar, Senior Economic Advisor from API. The topic today is our energy outlook. Guy, your agency is in the business of forecasting energy supplies, demand, and even prices. Can you tell our audience why forecasting energy is important and how your forecasts are used?
Sure, Jane. Maybe a surprising answer, but we are not using them as a predictor of prices or supply and demand. I think the most important use of forecasting is a systematic integration of the energy markets and supply and demand particularly into the longer term, 2030 and beyond. What that does is it forces you to make sure everything really fits together, and then that picture allows you to do what-if policy analysis. And it's used by Congress, it's used by investors, it's used by decision makers in the administration.
Well, we've seen some interesting things happen in the market over the past several weeks or months, and people are indeed asking questions about certain, perhaps they're anomalies, perhaps they're not, but maybe you could shed a little light on these things. For example, since the end of the summer, the price of crude oil has risen about $22 a barrel, up to about today around $91 a barrel. Can you explain why?
Our view of what's behind the price increases in these recent months and even for the last several years is it's primarily the fundamentals of supply-demand influenced by geopolitical tensions. So things like strong global economic growth, particularly in the developing countries like China and even in the Middle East itself, is really one of the main factors. But I think we can't ignore the role that OPEC has played in the last year or so in taking oil off the market by reducing the quotas. In so doing, they've had a influence on inventories, which have come down, and there's a limited amount of spare productive capacity. In addition to that, there continues to be tension in places like Iran, Iraq, Nigeria, and Venezuela, which certainly means that most of the risk on price is on the upside. And in a market where you have very little cushion, either in spare capacity to produce oil or in inventories, it requires a large price increase in the short run to rebalance the market when either supply is taken off the market or you have strong demand.
And those factors obviously would have an impact on gasoline prices. And we've seen that gasoline prices have risen, but not as sharply as the price of oil over the same time period. So why haven't gasoline prices kept pace with oil prices this fall?
I think the main reason is it's the time of the year when gasoline consumption is normally at its lowest levels. In the winter time, people drive less, and therefore the laws kind of supply and demand are at work, and that is with relatively less demand, it's been harder for refiners and distributors to pass through the full cost increase of the crude oil. Now, having said that, that is not the case when it comes to the middle distillate part of the barrel, which is where our heating oil comes from and where our diesel fuel for commercial vehicles come from. Those prices have kept up with crude oil prices and even have increased a bit more. So although gasoline is up, it's not up as much as crude oil prices, but on the other hand, heating oil and diesel fuel are up at least as much.
Real, how unusual is this? I mean, in general, don't gasoline prices track crude oil prices?
Well, certainly they do, especially over the long term. They're almost a mirror image of one another, but you can see a wide variation throughout the year with different products. For example, earlier this spring, we saw crude oil prices increase, but then we saw refined product prices, especially for gasoline, increase even higher. and that had a lot to do with a reduction in refining capacity and lower imports. So, and we saw the opposite shift in the fall, where we saw a decline in the margin for refiners. That is, they had to pay more for the crude, but they were unable to pass it through. As Guy said, so we'll have variations. We have two different markets. We have the crude market, and then we'll have a refined products market, too. But certainly when you're pulling up at the pump, you're spending over half of every dollar you're spending at the pump is going toward the cost of the crude oil alone. So that does make a big difference over the long term.
Well, here's a question for both of you, and I think it's something that people throughout America tend to ask fairly frequently. Who really determines the price of oil on the global markets or here in the United States and gasoline?
Well, ultimately, the consumers will determine the price. Having said that, in the short run, there is relatively little consumers can do because they're kind of stuck with the vehicles they own or the energy-using equipment they own. And in the short run, we're not in a level playing field. It's not a freely competitive market because of the fact that there is the cartel, OPEC cartel, and they are able to take oil off the market, which, as I pointed out earlier, contributed to the rising prices. Over the longer run, however, people will change their equipment. They will change their behavior, but that means we need time and investment, and that oftentimes is 3 to 5 years in the case of some equipment, and in others it's even a decade or more.
So it's really hundreds of thousands of decisions every day on the world's market between the buyers and the sellers, the demand and the supply that determines that price. And it's very complicated, and it really involves the entire world. We're connected to this world market for crude, and then we're even connected to the refined product market, too. So it's not one individual or a group. It's really a collective response and a collective value on the product worldwide.
Guy, gasoline isn't the only oil product that you track. What did your short-term energy outlook, which was released last week, say about other oil products, including heating oil, natural gas, propane, and other forms of energy that people in America use every day?
Yes, we track heating fuels very carefully, especially this time of the year. And the outlook for this winter is that consumers who use heating oil will face the largest increases in the expenditures. We're projecting there'll be about 33% higher this winter compared with last winter. For natural gas, the price increases have not been as large as they have been for oil, and that consumers heating with natural gas will be paying 6 or 7% more than last winter. And for propane, it's about a 20% increase. So all heating fuels are up this winter, but heating oil leads the way with the natural gas much lower.
Guy, you also watch global markets closely. What does the EIA project for the worldwide supply and demand for oil in 2008?
Well, in EIA's latest short-term energy outlook, we're projecting a 1.4 million barrel a day increase in world oil demand in 2008 compared with 2007. Of that 1.4 million barrels a day, most of the growth will be coming from China, the Middle East, and other developing countries on the demand side. And on the supply side, non-OPEC supplies are not expected to increase by enough to meet that growth in demand. Therefore, our projection is that OPEC will need to produce more oil in 2008 than they did in 2007. So those are critically important factors in that outlook for 2008.
Well, and as prices go up, you see a lot of pressure here in the United States for alternative forms of energy, including things like solar, wind, and other sources. Do you expect solar, wind, and geothermal and so on to have a larger share of the market in the future?
Yes, we've just released our long-term outlook, which goes to 2030, and we see the renewables part of the total energy picture in the U.S. growing faster in percentage terms. Of course, starting from a very low base, it's less than 7% of our total energy now. We see that increasing to about 9% in total energy. So the increase will be particularly strong in the electric power sector, going from 9% of our electric power generated by renewables to 12% in 2030. And the biggest growth will be in wind energy, followed by biomass.
Well, based on that then, how much oil do you think will be needed on an annual basis to fuel the world economy? You've been giving us domestic numbers, but if you see the same kind of growth in renewables throughout the world over a period of time, will we actually see the demand for oil decline, or will it continue to rise as well?
Well, our latest long-term outlook, again, on a global basis, sees renewables growing rapidly, but from a low base, so that the fossil fuels would continue to dominate the global picture. We expect the oil demand to increase from about 87 million barrels a day in 2008 to between 110 and 120 million barrels a day in 2030, assuming the existing assumptions about global economic growth and prices. So our view is that that growth will take place unless there are factors that are non-economic factors, which of course could change that.
Based on that projection then, Guy, do you think the world can produce enough oil to meet demand, say, in the year 2030?
We think the resources are there. The resources under the ground are there. Where our biggest concerns lie would be above-the-ground risks. We know very well about the number of geopolitical risks that are out there in regions where oil is known to exist, particularly the Middle East, which has been the subject of a number of disruptions. But even beyond that, thinking of Russia, Venezuela, Nigeria, all resource-rich countries with less than attractive investment regimes right now. And we need investment to make this happen, because to go from 87 million barrels a day to above 110 million barrels a day requires enormous investment to increase productive capacity, but also to make up for the natural decline rate in the existing fields.
I'd agree with Guy. We do have plenty of resources, and the biggest challenge moving forward will be the investment required. Estimates from the International Energy Agency, for example, say we're going to need at least $22 trillion of investment between now and 2030 to meet the world's energy needs. Half of that will have to be invested in oil and natural gas moving forward. So beyond the investment, we really need policy here in the United States and around the world that supports that investment, supports those opportunities, and recognizes we're going to need a lot more oil and natural gas. We're going to need all forms of energy moving forward, and protect and encourage those investments as we move into the future, so that we will have the energy we need at the best price we can get.
And at the same time, it probably would be a good idea for all of us to think about conservation and energy efficiency, would it not?
Oh, absolutely. We're the biggest consumer out there in the world in terms of oil, and even making a small difference in how we consume and the pace, the rate of growth in our consumption can make a difference, certainly in the long term. And I think there's a lot of room for improvement here at home that we could make and can make. And we can see changes right now in consumer behavior and in policy, too, that's supportive of that. So that's going to be important moving into the future. And it is also going to be important to invest, protect those investments, encourage them, and encourage a marketplace that will bring more energy to consumers here at home and around the world.
The main message that we've been trying to convey, and I think many others who are looking at the long-term future of energy, the International Energy Agency, the National Petroleum Council, a number of think tanks, is that there's no silver bullet, that this problem is so large that we need to attack it on every angle, and that starts with how we use energy. And when I talk about investment, I also mean investment in improved energy efficiency,
right, and technology,
both sides of the equation. in technology improvements, and all fuels. We need liquid fuels for transportation mm-hmm. sector. We will need a large number of fuels for the electric power sector mm-hmm. from coal, hopefully in a way that's more environmentally friendly, and as well as nuclear and renewables. We need it all.
Right, you're absolutely
right. If we're going
right.
to meet the kind of global economic demand growth that is projected by the International Monetary Fund and others who mm-hmm. look at global economy.
I think Guy's absolutely right. We can't afford to take anything off the table, and we have to encourage all forms of energy. And new investments in technology and how we use that energy moving forward is going to be very important to all of us.
If you had to sum it up into something that a message to energy consumers and energy decision makers is it's going to take time and investment and to try to do something to shortcut that process probably would mean doing it in the least economically efficient way.
Absolutely. And we want to keep it as efficient as we can so we have the lowest price we can possibly get, the biggest bang for our buck moving forward.
Exactly.
Well, Guy Caruso of EIA and Rayola Dewar of API, I want to thank you both for joining us today for a very interesting conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you for joining us on Energy Tomorrow Radio, brought to you by the people of America's oil and natural gas industry. For more information about this podcast or to submit questions for future shows, visit energytomorrow.org. That's energytomorrow.org.